me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on healing, health, living a long life. We're going to tell you what will happen when you eat enough of those good probiotics, the latest research on choline and why it's important. Also, we are not using a lot of the unexploited seeds that nature can provide, especially those from the Tunisian area, that are extremely rich in healing lipids. I'll give you the latest on that. If you're a teenager, you really have to pay attention to your health because 1 in 10 teens in the United States suffer some liver disease. It's never happened in American history. Why? I'll give you the latest on that. From our social issues area today, we're going to talk about, is America the most materialistic society in the history of the world? I'll be sharing my own insights that I was writing yesterday, in a quiet day of writing about 10 commentaries throughout the day, as well as using the Insights from Economic Collapse blog. My guest today will be James Howard Kunstler. He's an award-winning author, and he is also the author of Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. And I wanted to ask him about all these ads, you know, for all the latest iPhones, the 4, the 5s, whatever they are, and how people line up for them, making Apple the wealthiest corporation in the world, $700 billion. We have this idea of wishful thinking that technology will save us. What does this mean for us individually and the fate of our nation? Also today, I'll take a look at the drugs that don't work, a modern medical scandal. I'm going to share insights from Dr. Ben Goldacre, who wrote about his own research. Now, he's a medical doctor. He is also a researcher. And he did it all wrong. Now, mind you, this is not your typical MD. This is a doctor that before he decided to give a patient who was depressed the latest antidepressant, he went to the original scientific articles. That's what I do every morning at 4 a.m. And he read them. And he wanted to find the right drug for her. And he found what looked like very positive results. The drug didn't have major side effects, worked better than a placebo, and worked better than the other drugs of its type. Then his patient took it. What he didn't know was that he and all the doctors in the world, every single doctor, nurse on the planet, was being lied to and manipulated by every single pharmaceutical company. And they were doing it with the full knowledge and awareness of their boards and all members of Congress that sit on these boards and the medical magazines. They get all the revenue and the medical schools and the doctors for hire, the scientists for hire, the writers for newspapers on health columns that reprint anything the pharmaceutical industry sends through one of his PR firms. So everybody was in on the scam. And I'll tell you what that scam is. And I'll tell you how he discovered it. And he published it. Where? In the United States? No, you'd never see an article like this in the United States. Never. No, it was in The Guardian. So this is important, and I'll share that with you. Now, I don't know if time permits. If time does not permit, I'll share this on my 3 o'clock show on with our WPFW show of one of our sister stations. And I realize you can't listen to that over the Internet or over the air live unless you're in the Washington, D.C. area. However, we post every one of my daily 3 o'clock shows a little later on in the afternoon, so you won't miss any of it. I want to talk about the America's decaying infrastructure. It'll just blow your mind. And there's bad news, everything about our infrastructure is gone to hell. And there's good news. We could repair it all if we put a Marshall Plan together to get rid of all the old grids, put in new grids, protect us from solar storms, protect us from rolling blackouts, put in new natural and non-toxic, non-polluting green energy like geothermal and wind. Wind not in any urban area where there's homes, because those 400-foot towers are a nightmare in those areas. Depress the property value. They don't get any money from it. Kill birds. But if you put them up high in the Rockies, perfect. Because they're out of sight. They're not harming anything. And they take those constant 24-hour currents of air. You ever flown from New York to California? And about three-quarters of the way through your flight, when you go over the Great Continental Divide, where Colorado is, you get that real bumpiness, real turbulence. That's where the strongest air currents are in the United States. And it runs for about 1,000 miles. Then offshore on both sides. So plenty of places for wind turbines, but not where we've been putting them. Solar is our greatest advantage, plus wind currents. We could rebuild our entire infrastructure, making us no longer require any coal, oil, or gas, or nuclear. We could put at least 10 million Americans to work. We could reforest the country. We could reverse some tipping points. I'll go into that. And also, we never pay attention to Britain, and we should. One person, Colin Todhunter, writing from Global Research, says that Britain isn't a country. It's merely a client state of America. So, I thought it was interesting when I read his commentary. I'll share that with you. Also, I just want to give a little heads up about what we're going to be doing later. We have a program every Monday evening at 7 o'clock. It is the most downloaded radio show that I'm aware of in the United States. I mean, just gazillion people download it and listen to it live. It's called the Progressive Commentary Hour. It's only one topic. Always serious. No fun with this one. It's the best minds on the planet coming together to address an important issue, whether it's the war on drugs that we shouldn't be having, or whether it's the privatization of our educational system, whether it's the World Bank, International Monetary Fund. We really go in depth. Today, the complete and total failure of America's foreign policy in the Middle East, past, present, and future. You want to know why they're angry with us? Well, Professor Juan Cole, who is a Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, will be one of the panelists. We have other panelists as well. We have Rick Razoff, Felicity Arbuthnot, and Michael Chofskadesky. So we have some interesting people coming on. You won't want to miss that. That's once a week. Now, let's go to the latest on health and healing. It is my opinion that if you have a planned, if you have any form of planned pregnancy, you should ask yourself, you may be financially fine, even emotionally fine, no negative baggage, no therapy, all of which would end up pulsing negative energy, which could become epigenetically disturbing to your developing fetus. And by the way, in 3 weeks, I'm doing a whole 2 to 3 hours just on that topic, how we become our mother's and father's energy prior to pregnancy, then during pregnancy, then following pregnancy. A whole interesting topic. So anyway, I believe that we should make sure that our body, physical bodies, our DNA, our cells are as clean and balanced and healthy as they can be. This is the latest in this. This is from a peer-reviewed journal. This was done at the Nutrition Research Institute, University of North Carolina. It says, mother's diet before pregnancy can change the gene function and her offspring. Quote, it has been long known that nutrition during pregnancy affects the well-being of her child, but a new study suggests that what a woman eats before she becomes pregnant also plays a significant role. And then they found that when you're eating things they're using for the first time in mainstream medicine in this context, epigenetic. Now, this was coined by Bruce Lipton, the molecular biologist. It will epigenetically impact your metabolism of fatty acids, and also this could end up causing diabetes, obesity, cancer, and other immune disorders later in life. So everything that you eat when you're pregnant can make a difference in the DNA of your child. Very important. Now, my generation, the baby boomers, our mothers routinely breastfed us. We also were given cod liver oil every day, especially in the wintertime. We were exposed to the winter. My mother put all of my brothers out on the porch and let us play out there in the middle of the winter, no matter how cold it was, snowing anything. And, of course, we'd be bundled up and have, you know, clothes on. And I later asked her why. Why did you have us out there in that cold? She said it made you hardy. She said if you stay indoors with the windows closed and the heat on, you're not going to have a strong immune system. My mother had no background in nutrition. She had a background in common sense. She was right. That's all the evidence today shows that. So anyhow, really detoxify. How long? I'm going to suggest that it will take about a year to prepare your body for pregnancy, minimally. Ideally, 2 years. Well, most people in today's world, their pregnancies are not planned, they're unplanned, and also they're impatient. But you're really putting your child's genes at risk if you don't do this the right way. Last week I mentioned there was a study showing that those who ate yogurt had more protective chemicals in their body that had helped them lower their blood pressure. Now there's another study, and this one also shows that hypertension, which we know is frequently not known, the average person never tests themselves for high blood pressure. And that's why it's called the silent killer. You can't feel it. You don't know you have it until you have a stroke. Well, according to the American Heart Association, untreated high blood pressure damages and scars your arteries. Now, what happens is little tears and scars in the artery can act like a net catching debris traveling through the bloodstream, like cholesterol, and that creates plaque, which then leads to a buildup. And it's important to be aware of blood pressure measurements because symptoms are many times non-existent. Well, in this particular study, they again used yogurt, and I don't believe it had anything in the world to do with yogurt. I know it doesn't. I've done too many studies. It had to do with the probiotics and the fact that these were non-sugared yogurts. So if you simply took probiotics each day, I'm suggesting 5 to 100 billion a day, throughout the day, that you could end up impacting your systolic blood pressure, and that would make a difference. Why do I know this? Because I've conducted 47 clinical trials. As far as I know, I could be wrong, but I've looked, those are the most amount of actual clinical studies on humans ever done by anyone in the health field ever. And I have a new one coming up starting hopefully in January. It'll last a year. It'll be with people who have been diagnosed and are being currently treated for Alzheimer's at any stage. I have to have the full, complete medical documentation before a person's invited into the study. It's free, and it's completely medically supervised, and they have to go through our own battery of medical exams, again, all of which are free. And then it has nothing to do with medicine. It's a completely 100% lifestyle and behavior modification and dietary approach. I've been able to improve or reverse Alzheimer's, including end-stage Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and other conditions, but I need a large group to really make this evident that they've got the wrong approach and we should shift completely. So that'll start. If you know someone who would like to participate in this, and I'll be doing it in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New York, and you can be connected by the Internet, and that way you don't have to travel. In any case, you have to send that information to Gary Noll, 2307 Broadway, New York, New York 10024. So what I was saying is when I did, for example, the blood pressure study, where to get into the study you had to have a consistently high blood pressure and medical treatment and medication, and then we started. I think we had 161 people in that particular study. Over a period of 6 months, using nothing but lifestyle and behavior modification, meaning exercise, stress management, good diet, detoxing, we were able to help 90% of the people drop their blood pressure into the safe ranges, so safe that their doctors took them off their meds or reduced them. And the probiotics were an essential part of that, because one group, we did not suggest probiotics. One group, we did. The probiotic group had a greater reduction. So I definitely feel the probiotics are crucial for blood pressure. Next up, there's a nutrient called choline, C-H-O-L-I-N-E, choline. Generally, people who are lacking in proper brain energy use choline. But there's a new study that says, quote, consumption of higher levels of choline throughout early pregnancy may help lower the infant's vulnerability to stress-related illnesses, in addition to protecting against chronic conditions later in life. Well, that's important. That's very important. This was done at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And they gave them higher than normal amounts of choline in the diet during pregnancy. And it changed, quote, the epigenetic markers. See where we're seeing this all over and over again. Modification of our DNA that tell our genes to switch on or off in the fetus and could help lead to a healthier later life. Quote, this study is important because it shows that a relatively simple nutrient can have significant effects in prenatal life. While our results won't change practice at this point, the idea that maternal choline intake could essentially change fetal genetic expression into adulthood is quite novel, end quote. And that was the lead researcher. So, good news, choline, you don't have to have a lot of it, anywhere from 200 to 500 milligrams a day if you're pregnant. If you're not pregnant, to help your brain, 500 milligrams. Now, there are a lot of seed oils in the world that are not being used that are richer than what we use. We generally use soy oil, cottonseed oil, which I would never use, and I would never use soybean oil unless it was from non-genetically engineered soy, and also sunflower oil. But they're finding lipid-rich oils, and this was published in Lipids and Health and Disease. Quote, minor lipid components of some of the acaia species have benefits of the unexploited seeds. And that's all throughout Tunisia. So what the likelihood is that now that this has come out, there will be those who will start to bring in these oils from Tunisia. Maybe some of the people in this audience could do that as their own home-based business. Start bringing in some of those Tunisian species of oil. There's lots of them. There's the acyclops, the ligatilia, the salicinia, all kinds. Something novel. There are over 1,350 different species worldwide, but they're almost all from Tunisia, and you don't see a single one in any health food store in America. So my idea is maybe that might motivate someone out there to do this as a business. No one else is doing it. These are better oils than what we're buying in the health food store. So just like coconut oil was unknown, no one used coconut oil 10 years ago. Now it's the number one oil because someone got the idea and brought it in, like coconut water. So there's something for you. And finally, this is an important study. Data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey looked at 10,359 teenagers, 12 to 18, over a 10-year period. And they published the data, and they found this. They said, quote, a shocking 1 in 10 American teens are now suffering from liver disease, a direct result of the distortion and pollution of our food system that allows fructose to be treated as if it's perfectly safe. Quote, in a shocking report that bodes ill for the future health of the generation now entering adulthood, 10% of today's teens suffer from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Even more ominously, the study, which was done through Emory University, stated that, quote, it seems that to be increasing faster than the prevalence of obesity, end quote. Previously, the disease had been very closely associated with obesity. Now it's clear that there's more than excess weight driving the increase in liver disease. Now, here's the point. High fructose corn syrup is known to be associated with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now that we're seeing this once rare disorder affecting 1 in 10 teenagers, we have to put the blame 100% upon the FDA, because they're the ones who approve it as safe. And they're the ones who are in complete cooperation with the out-of-control agribusiness. And agribusiness uses it in all those soft drinks. So don't drink anything with fructose, high corn fructose. It's bad for you. It's bad to the bone. And you shouldn't have it. And it's damaging the liver. All right? I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest in the health and nutrition update. We spend our first 20 minutes every day on this. Now I want to shift gears and share something from our issues. This is from Dr. Ben Goldacre, as published in The Guardian. And I'll quote a small part of it verbatim. And then I'm going to play you a clip that is absolutely devastating. There is a drug. It is called Reboxetine. Quote, it is a drug that I have prescribed. Other drugs have done nothing for my patients, so we wanted to try something new. I'd read the trial data before I wrote the prescription and found only well-designed, fair test with overwhelming positive results. Reboxetine was better than a placebo and as good as any other antidepressant in head-to-head comparisons. It's approved for use by the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, which governs all drugs in the UK. Millions of doses are prescribed every year around the world. Reboxetine was clearly a safe and effective treatment. The patient and I discussed the evidence briefly and agreed it was the right treatment to try. I signed a prescription. But we had both been misled. A group of researchers was finally able to bring together all the data that had ever been collected on reboxetine, both from trials that were published, but from those that had never appeared in any academic papers. When all this trial data was put together, it produced a shocking picture. 7 trials had been conducted comparing reboxetine against a placebo. Only one, conducted in a tiny 254 patient, had a neat positive result, and that one was published in an academic journal for doctors and researchers to read. But 6 more trials were conducted in almost 10 times as many patients. All of them showed that reboxetine was no better than a sugar pill. None of these trials were published. I had no idea they existed. It got worse. The trials comparing reboxetine against other drugs showed exactly the same picture, meaning that they didn't work, and they had serious side effects. And that was really bad because that was left out. I did everything a doctor is supposed to do. I read all the papers. I critically appraised them. I understood them. I discussed them with my patient, and we made a decision together based upon the evidence. In the published data, reboxetine was a safe and effective drug. In reality, it was no better than a sugar pill, and worse, it does more harm than good. As a doctor, I did something that, on the balance of all the evidence, harmed my patient, simply because unflattering data was left unpublished. Nobody broke any law in that situation. Reboxetine is still on the market, and the system that allowed all this to happen is still in play. For all drugs in all countries in the world, negative data goes missing for all treatments in all areas of science. The regulators and professional bodies we have would reasonably expect to stamp out such practices have failed us. These problems have been protected from public scrutiny because they're too complex to capture in a soundbite. This is why they've gone unfixed by politicians, at least to some extent. But it's also why it takes detail to explain. The people you should have been able to fix the problem have failed you, and because you have to understand a problem properly in order to fix it, And then he goes into all the ways that all these, and I'll just summarize what he says is in the remaining, it's a long article. He says that virtually all the science today that is controlled by industry, they intentionally set up the study in ways that it minimizes their failure. I'll give you one example. When I was along with our scholar in residence, one of them, and our producer, Richard Gale, we wrote 20 articles rebutting the safety and efficacy of vaccines, especially the flu vaccine and H1N1, that there was no evidence that did either prevented H1N1 or prevented the flu. But it's amazing what we found and what people are not aware of, that they control how a project is designed. So let's say with a vaccine for women, the flu vaccine, if you had heart disease, you weren't given it. Cancer, you weren't given it. Antidepressants, you weren't given it. Any problem with alcohol or drugs, you weren't given it. If you had had infections, you weren't given it. Well, suddenly you've just excluded about half of all the women in the United States that would take a vaccine, and so you only gave it to completely healthy women. But we don't have a nation with all healthy women. So the vaccine trial was with only healthy women, yet the vaccine was given to all women. That is a completely fraudulent study, and that's all the studies that you see out there. They're all fraudulent. So that's what he's saying. So the next time your doctor says, well, you know, sorry your treatment hasn't worked for chemotherapy, but there is this new drug, and I've read this report on it, and it seems to have some interesting, they're just experimenting on you. You're nothing but, you're a rat in a cage, you're a human guinea pig, and all of our federal agencies are complicit. Our legislators are complicit. The Surgeon General of the United States is complicit. The head of Health and Human Services is complicit. The head of the National Cancer Institute is complicit. They all are complicit. So we can't reform this system. The entire health edifice in America must be completely deconstructed, and one that represents true science, true healing, true medicine, true compassion, and true care, replacing it. Anything less, and we will continue to have the devastating consequences we see today. I'm Gary Noll. Those are my thoughts. And we're going to go to this clip, come back with our guest. Stay with us.
These rats have been fed with transgenic corn during their entire life cycle. The tumors they suffer from are enormous. The study that revealed the effect of the GMOs on the health of these rats has just been completed. It benefited from exceptional financial and technical means. We were able to witness the study in its entirety. It lasted for 2 years. Following years of doubt and controversies, will we finally know the truth about GMOs? Would we then be faced with a health crisis of global proportions?
This is the longest, most thorough study to have been carried out on a GMO, and we have also carried out a joint study on the most used pesticide in the world, the Roundup, which is a herbicide. It belongs to the main pesticide category. We spent over a year trying to obtain transgenic corn because no GMO manufacturers were willing to provide them. This is because Monsanto requires contracts to be signed stipulating that the seeds must not be used for testing and an arrangement must be made prior to the testing. We wanted our study to be independent.
This is the first time that a 2-year study has been conducted on GMOs. And there lies the big difference. Furthermore, we tried to evaluate a maximum of biochemical and biological parameters with repeated blood tests, weighing of the specimens, and urine tests. We studied the hepatic and urinary parameters, as well as the blood parameters, all the parameters that can be studied. We also studied the hormonal parameters, which has never been done in previous studies. This experiment is a world premiere.
Up until now, the corn NK603, the very one selected for the study, had only been tested over a 3-month period, and that in a test environment entirely controlled by Monsanto, its manufacturer. Furthermore, concerning the Roundup, also manufactured by Monsanto, and which is used for growing corn, only its active agent, glyphosate, had been assessed. But one needs to understand that the manufacturers, in order to enable the active agent to penetrate the plant cell successfully, use additives that are sometimes more harmful than the actual glyphosate.
We have two clear objectives. Firstly, to conduct the studies exactly according to international requirements, but making sure to be very thorough when it comes to analyzing the results. Secondly, we want to determine if there are secondary effects. The only way to do this is to carry out tests on animals and then to examine all the blood parameters whilst paying close attention to their organs.
At this stage, it might prove useful to know exactly what GMOs are used for. It is a plant that has been developed either to produce its own insecticide or to be tolerant to a herbicide, thus enabling it to be exposed to massive doses of it without dying. One can understand how GMOs could be useful to farmers. For example, they would be able to spray their entire field with Roundup, killing all the weeds in the process and never harming the genetically modified plant. On the other hand, it is hard to see the benefits for the consumer, who will effectively be ingesting substances coming from a plant that has absorbed pesticides. That is why it is crucial to test not only the GMO, but also the GMO with its residue and the pesticide on its own.
This type of testing had never been done before because the corporations doing the tests would do them on GMOs with the Roundup, which meant that we had no idea what between the GMO and the Roundup caused the pathologies, or they did them on GMOs without specifying that this was the case. So what we decided to do was to address the question, are we dealing with the effects of the GMO or the pesticide? During the last 10 years of testing, the National Commission did not envisage a pesticide effect.
Therefore, Europe does not even demand that chronic toxicity tests be systematically carried out on animals, and when they are required, it is the manufacturers who decide the protocol to be used. For example, the Amflora potato was only tested on a group of 30 rats, 10 of which were being fed the GMO. The Monsanto corn was tested on 400 rats. 80 of them were fed the transgenic plant, but only 40 of them were then subjected to blood tests. Either way, none of these studies lasted longer than 90 days.
What is represented by this figure is that certain groups of rats, male and female, have ingested GMO corn. GMO corn with Roundup residue and Roundup on its own. Every time we go up a level, a rat dies. The limit is 10 due to the number of rats that constitute a group. The dotted line represents the females of the group who die but have a completely normal diet. Only two animals die spontaneously after 550 days. On the other hand, every female that has been fed on the GMO with Roundup or Roundup diet has died more frequently than the other rats. Some will challenge the relevance of such results, but what is undeniable is that in the group that has been exposed to the GMOs, there is a 600% increase or six times more deaths compared to the control group. As far as medicine or biology is concerned, there is no need for further testing.
An important fact is that all the studies carried out on the rats are done over a 3-month period. It so happens that none of the effects are visible until the 4th month. This is fundamental in understanding that studies conducted over a 3-month period are useless. This conclusion is easily understandable. It could be said that their only use is to soothe the consciences.
Every rat out of the 200 that were tested was dissected by Professor Seralini's team. They did this to discover exactly what had affected their organs. The purpose behind this was to identify the way each diet, GMO, GMO and Roundup on its own, had acted on the metabolism of each animal, focusing on the development rate of the tumors that, and this comes as no surprise, only start to manifest themselves after the initial 3-month period.
This figure represents the number of palpable tumors contracted by the animal during the experiment. Here, we can see the rats subjected to GMOs compared to those with a regular diet. As you can see, very few males have contracted tumors. This is due to them being more resistant to the testing process. What these figures show are the large tumors. Each step up represents a large tumor, which can measure 17 millimeters by 17 millimeters. For a rat, these measurements are colossal. It would equate to a tumor of this size if seen on a human being. It is enormous. After having studied these tumors, it can be said that 94% of them take effect in the mammary glands, which would equate to breast cancer in a woman. We are faced with renal tumors for the males, but not only, some males also suffer from mammary tumors. This points towards a hormonal effect that isn't affected by the dosage. 60% of breast cancer cases are caused by hormonal deficiencies.
Professor Seralini's study holds one last surprise for us, and this is a major one. Up until now, one could have thought that the main cause of death for the tested rat was coming from the pesticide added to the corn. But what the study highlighted, and this for the first time ever, is the fact that the transgenesis itself could have killed the rats. What this means is that just by interfering with the genome of the plant in order to modify it, we are faced with repercussions that no one could have anticipated. This is enough to make us reconsider all the scientific precepts that led to the creation of GMOs.
Roundup had never been tested separately. Whilst conducting cellular studies, we saw that the cells of the liver, embryos, kidneys, placenta, and the umbilical cord died much faster, and so we could deduce that there was a toxic effect on the organism. What can be said is that there is an increase in deaths due to GMOs and Roundups. The biggest surprise came when we realized that GMOs without any Roundup residue were responsible for an increase in the death rate of females and of some males. This could be the result of the GMO gene that has been badly assimilated by the plant and that has therefore resulted in a negative effect or due to a secondary metabolical effect.
What that means is that we are dealing with a GMO in particular, a modification of a cereal or a GMO corn. With regard to the genes inserted in the corn to make it a GMO corn can result in different effects. It is not because a certain GMO has a particular effect that other GMOs will have an effect, but some may even have more of an impact.
What is alarming, this is the GMO that is being eaten by the Americans, but also the GMO that has been approved for importation by European agencies, including the French ones, and that obviously contaminates our food.
Nowadays, only two types of GMOs are being produced in a few European countries. One is corn and the other potato. But what about the 27 million tons of transgenic soya that are unloaded each year in European ports? This soya is used to feed our cattle, but it also makes its way into a number of foodstuffs.
What we want to achieve with this study is a moratorium. The situation is serious enough and we're not going to eat everything and anything. We imported without knowing what was being imported, and the United States have produced crops without knowing what they were producing. There needs to be more study of this kind, and GMO manufacturers need to conduct them before commercializing their products.
A moratorium on
what you've been
GMOs
listening to is an exclusive, never before heard or seen interview with a group of the finest independent academic French scientists. And what you're not seeing because you're only hearing the audio clip are grossly distorted bodies of mice and rats. Sometimes the tumor was as large as the rat itself. And just to give you a quick overview, this is the same type of GMO that's used in the United States today. They're showing that the GMO by itself caused tumors with the glyphosate, which is the Roundup, and the GMO together, that it caused 600% increase in cancers, renal cancer, breast cancer. So here is a question. It could not have escaped the researchers doing this. that if they kept the study at 3 months, they could say to the FDA or USDA or the American public, we saw no adverse effects. The French scientists are saying the effects start after 3 months. That's the manipulation I was referring to earlier of American science. So just understand that the truth is not on their side. GMOs are dangerous. It's Russian roulette. And as you will see, when I flew out to California a couple weeks ago to film some of the leading experts in this, then went up to Canada, then to India, then to Spain, then to every place else to finish this film I'm working on. When you eat something that's GMO originated, it becomes your cell. Those who say it does not impact your genome, they are simply wrong. So now you know the truth. And I will post this so that I think that the White House, the USDA, American media should take a look at this, at least those who are going to look for the truth instead of continuing to support Monsanto, DuPont, and the GMO industry. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go to my guest who's standing by now, James Howard Kunstler. I gave you his background and bio earlier. He is an award-winning author, and he looks at challenges of the American urban and suburban culture, including climate change. And his one of his books was The Long Emergency, dealing with these, and now it's his newest one is Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, it's nice to be here.
James, we are frequently hearing about new technological innovations and new electronic wonders that are supposed to improve our lives and make our lives easier. However, when I look at the economic environment and try to imagine where it's heading in light of unsustainable capital reserves, a failing banking system, and a military-industrial complex and war machine now fully wedded to government, I have to ask, will we be able to afford all these new technological contraptions as more and more people struggle just to have decent food on their tables, and yet we continue to hold out on so-called solutions fed to us by bureaucrats and corporations and the media that convince us America's innovative technological creativity will pull us through, not just in scientific technology, but also in economic and political architecture that we are being told is tackling the problems and crisis awaiting us? So for you, I'm asking, to address these, in your opinion, is this just a delusional myth? And if so, begin by identifying the underlying reasons why more technology and our wishing and hoping harder and the promises that we place in such technologies are delusional.
Well, I'm glad that question wasn't on my college boards because it's very complicated. But my latest book, Too Much Magic, is largely concerned with the diminishing returns of technology and the unanticipated consequences and blowback. And I think the answer to your question is that most of the things that we're now preoccupied with in terms of technology really have nothing to say to us about the major predicaments that we're in. And these are the predicament of energy and how we are going to power our civilization in the years to come, and the predicaments of money, banking, and finance, and the operations of capital. And the technology in that realm is only doing an enormous amount of damage by destroying the functions of markets. So I have a way of looking at technology that I refer often to our techno-narcissism and our techno-grandiosity, because we've been living through about 150 years of a cavalcade of one technological wonder after another, and we're programmed to assume that if we get into trouble, that the cavalcade of wonders will not only continue, but will pull us out of the predicament that we're in, as well as solving all of the problems caused by previous technological innovations and advances. So the bottom line is we have to be very, very careful about our techno-narcissism and our techno-grandiosity, because it is causing us to make choices and to behave in ways that are not going to benefit us in the future.
Okay. Well, then let's segue over to what is the relationship or the equation between the peak oil reality and the financial environment, and how is this being used by the financial sector in order to destabilize the entire system?
Oh, I don't think that peak oil is being used by the financial establishment to destabilize the system. I think that these are two circumstances that we face. They're not related conspiracies. The peak oil and peak fossil fuel problem is simply a fact of life. It's a circumstance. And, you know, it's self-explanatory. We are going to get less and less petroleum in particular, and it's going to cost more and more, and the quality of it is going to be poorer and poorer, and it is going to cost a lot more to get it out of the ground. And that's just a fact. The relationship with the economy is simply that our paradigm of economic growth is tied strictly to our energy supply. And if we don't have a growing energy supply, as has been the case for the last several hundred years, we're not going to have a growing economy, and we're not going to be able to service the debt that we've generated, and we're going to, as a result, see an implosion of the operations of capital and impairments in the tremendously important process of capital formation. And that's already happening. It's been happening for several years, and it's not, you know, it wasn't a coincidence that peak conventional oil occurred around 2006, 2007, and that the banking crisis began to work its hoodoo on us around 2007, 2008, because they are deeply related. It's just that we don't want to pay attention to that, and one of the sort of sideshows of the peak oil story is that we are telling ourselves so many fairy tales about technology and oil and energy that we simply have divorced the truth from reality. And the truth is we don't have 100 years of shale gas. And the truth is that shale oil is extremely difficult and expensive and to get out of the ground, and requires enormous amounts of capital, and the very impairments in capital formation that that have begun to affect us are going to make it ever more difficult to finance the operations of shale gas and shale oil that we're now hoping are going to solve all our problems, along with, you know, tar sands, deep water drilling, and a few other things. So we're really stuck in a trap, and we, you know, you can state categorically that the delusional thinking rises in direct proportion to the distress that a society feels. And we are a pretty distressed society, and we're getting pretty delusional.
I would agree with that. I'd like to apply your idea of toxic psychology that dominates the discussions today and our public and media, and in particular government and the corporate culture, to the idea that we find a correlation between those who deny peak oil that you just mentioned and those who also deny climate change. Would you elaborate on this relationship between the two, and in particular peak oil denialism, since we are being led to believe that the U.S. is or will shortly be the next net exporter of fossil fuels, that we have unlimited supplies off our coast and in different parts of the United States, including out in Utah? And then also, if you could go into greater depth of how our continuing to place faith in technological solutions is binding us to the reality of a peak oil world and its consequences.
Well, it's really pretty simple. And it has to do with, you know, a dynamic that I would call the psychology of previous investment. And the basic idea is that we've poured our national wealth into a an infrastructure for daily life that has no future. We can't afford to live in it, and we can't afford to run it. And I'm referring to, you know, the American dream suburban living arrangement, which is where most of Americans live and many work. And, you know, it's not an accident that I wrote several books about the fiasco of suburbia before I wrote The Long Emergency and Too Much Magic, which were largely concerned with the bigger picture questions of how we're going to carry on civilization. And because of the psychology of previous investment, you know, this induces the wish to keep all of the stuff running the way it's designed to run at all costs. And so that's, you know, what we've seen is a political process now that is dedicating itself to a campaign to sustain the unsustainable. You know, and that's why there's really very little difference between what Barack Obama expects and what Mitt Romney expects. And, you know, both parties, really, all the politics of the USA right now are geared towards the unrealistic expectation that we're going to keep running Walt Disney World, Walmart, the interstate highway system, the U.S. military, and the suburbs at all costs.
Hmm. Very insightful. I really appreciate that statement, James. My final question for you is, and I know you're not big on offering solutions and to try to come up with a technological solution to the crisis we're now entering would just seem to fall back into wishful thinking, but you speak of the need for dramatic change in human behavior in order for people to gain some semblance of sustainability in their lives. Would you please address the identifying characteristics of such change behavior? And for people coming up to the end of our regular 55-minute program, you're listening to James Howard Kunstler. His website is Kunstler, K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R.com. His book is Too Much Magic. And if your station cuts off before he's finished his answer, you can continue listening by calling 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or just go to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNall.com. Please continue.
Well, Gary, I've forgotten the question now.
Solutions.
Solutions. I'm not against the idea of solutions. I'm just against what our current idea of those solutions is. You know, for example, in places where environmental intellectuals gather, all they want to talk about is running the cars by other means, you know, hybrid cars, electric cars, et cetera. Cars run on algae secretions. But, you know, they're really not interested in talking about some of the things that would really help, like walkable communities or public transit. You know, one of my big peeves is the idea that we desperately need to fix the conventional railroad system in America or we're not going to go anywhere because commercial aviation is going to implode and the happy motoring system is in its twilight. And we desperately need to fix the conventional railroad system that's lying out there rusting in the rain. We're too broke to build high-speed rail now. We missed that opportunity. And the impairments of capital formation will prevent that from happening. But, you know, there is no political discussion about repairing the railroad system in America. It's not in the arena. It's not even there in the room with the other elephants. And it's the kind of thing that shows that we are not a serious people. It's very unfortunate.
I appreciate your work. As always, you're right out there telling us what you think in the clearest terms. And you've given us a lot to ponder. Thank you very much, James, for coming on and sharing this.
Hey, you're welcome, Gary.
James Howard Kunstler, just quite simply one of the best minds around. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi, and I will open up our lines now for talk back at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And at 3 o'clock today, I will deal with, is America the most materialistic society in history? A commentary I've written. And 21 facts about America's decaying infrastructure and what we could do about it. And I have a lot of other things. Praying on the Poor is another commentary. You will be able to download those later this evening on Progressive Radio Network. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a very interesting insight here from one of your listeners. They were commenting on the fact that a lot of our Olympic athletes and world-class athletes, as they age, they kind of slow down, and maybe they start getting into commercials and things like that, and they kind of become people of the past who maybe broke a record or maybe did well in a sport. And what the reader is commenting, I don't know if they've been in the running club or what, but they said that what they're noticing is that as you're aging, you in particular, you're not only still active as an athlete, but you're still competing, you're still winning medals, and you're still breaking records. And they were very curious about this, and they're wondering, why is it that you know, you're such an anomaly that, A, people aren't recognizing this and maybe utilizing it as an inspiration for them. Why isn't this something that's like front page news for people? You're not fading into the background in your athletics. You're challenging yourself and going even further, which is really virtually unseen anywhere else.
Are you familiar with Kierkegaard?
Yes.
He said, what our age lacks is not reflection, but passion. I am passionate about change that we can measure and that we can learn from. When I was competing in, let's say, 20 years ago, I'll just take one example of 1 year. I would train 100 miles a week on the road. I would do 2 hours a day on the VersaClimber. I'd run the steps of my building 25 times. There was a whole group of us that did it together. On Monday nights, the guys would come up, and we'd have 20 guys working out my apartment. I had a big apartment on 86th Street at that time. And on Tuesday night, the women would come up because there's simply too many for all of us to come at the same time. Very serious workouts. All of those people became really outstanding athletes. And a lot of it had to do with be passionate about what you're doing. Look for the deeper meaning of what you're doing. And it wasn't about winning, because it was my policy never to go to the award ceremonies afterwards. Just do the race, congratulate everyone else that was there, cheer them on, and go home. And then what was the lesson learned? And in our society, we compete for the wrong reasons. We compete for the gold instead of competing to see how much better we can be than what we thought we could. And then as you age, in our society, the stereotype message is you'll never be as good, as strong, as fast, as flexible, as nimble as you were before when you were younger. Well, that isn't true. Someone recently emailed me a record that I still have. In the 40K National Championship, I was the only master athlete to ever win the overall open division against all athletes that day, including many of the greatest athletes in America at that time. And it was not my commitment that allowed me to win that race. It was my passion. Because I remember at the end of the 6-mile or 10K mark, and we had to go almost a marathon, 24.8 miles, a very hilly course, a hot boiling day in August. And the guy I was pacing with, Franco, said, you know, we better try to just hold our pace because this is really hot. And in that moment, my passion said no. And I started my sprint. What you normally do with 100 feet left in a race, I did with 18 miles left. And I never stopped. Passion to push myself by allowing the mind to be in a place, what is called the zone, where you're simply aware that you are a part of the energy of your own creation and all that nature has. So when I finished the race, I couldn't remember anything. I just couldn't remember a thing. And I had others, the judges and other people, you know, came and, you know, said, what the hell just happened? Well, that's the kind of mindset I believe that you have to have with everything you do in life, where you almost don't know what's happening because your passion is so strong. Now, what about the passion to heal? Look what that would do for a doctor who wouldn't then just be playing cookbook medicine. A nurse to look at what it means to be a patient and say, if that's my mother in that bed, what drugs would I encourage her to take, or which would I not allow a doctor to prescribe? How could she should she get bed sores because of my negligence or be prevented? Should she get staph or strep infections because of lack of cleanliness, or my conviction that this is a room that no patient will be getting an infection in? A banking system or political system that works for the people and not for special interest. Put that passion to a higher principle in everything you do in life, and then you will no longer associate age and reality, because you will be as young as your passion allows you to be. And therefore, there's no reason you shouldn't be competing and doing well as you get older. So you have to, in effect, stop reading from the prepared text that says this is the way it's going to be because it's the way it's always been. And that's how we think in our society. The average American spends 28 hours a week in front of a television. There's no passion. We have the highest rate of divorce in the world. There's no passion. We have the highest rate of focusing on dysfunctional relationships and dysfunctional behavior and making it almost a sport. Where's the higher passion? And we are lonely and surround ourselves with things to distract us. Where's our passion for an authentic life? So I believe when you put an authentic life first and you allow no rules that have been established that you must abide by, that limit you and cast you based upon your race, your ethnicity, your religion, your age, your education, your financial circumstances, then you're not living by those rules and limited by them. And right now, almost all of our problems, all of them, are based upon people not realizing the strength and power they have because they're living by someone else's rules. And think of all the athletes. My final thought is this. I think it would be great, and one of my goals is, in the next 2 years, to buy a piece of property specifically and exclusively to design it as a sports complex, baseball, soccer, football, swimming, tennis, basketball, every kind of sport, the full field, whatever it is, and then to invite retired athletes to come there to live for a year and to see within a year of totally rejuvenating them, totally detoxifying them, totally changing their DNA and totally getting their mindset back, how much they could reclaim of what they had before. And I'm willing to bet that there'll be a lot of athletes that would do as well or better than they did earlier and be healthier and happier in the process, because then they'd be doing it for a different reason, with a different mindset. That's never existed. That's one of my goals. Right now I'm just finishing a veterans village that I'm building. One goal at a time, but it takes passion even to have a goal. It takes passion to have a dream. Hope that answers your question.
Yes.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. Now stay tuned for Utrice Lead, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
You better stop, yeah!